Welcome to episode 109 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician, professor at UGA, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. 40 years ago today was the invention of the compact disc. Now, for those of interested in music, this had some interesting ramifications. But for the clinicians among us, this is when patients started carrying not the loads of paper, but the things that we put onto discs and eventually DVDs, including video clips that have made our lives infinitely more challenging.
I remember actually 35 years ago, one of the first things I bought together with my wife, Laura, was a CD player. And I think it was a CD of the Vigilantes of Love, if I remember right, an Athens band. Great band. And on this podcast, we talk about old music and we highlight poems, which are patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want to get them all, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a poem daily, plus a primary care reference, over 800 disease and symptom chapters, thousands of interactive decision support tools. Go to essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. For a nominal annual fee, you can get CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. Just go to IAFP.com, click on their education webpage, and find our podcast. This week on Primary Care Update, we're going to discuss motivational interviewing for weight loss. Does that work? Intensive urate lowering in persons with gout, is that better than standard urate lowering? And the idea of screening for anal cancer, does that have a benefit? So Kate, you kick us off, please.
You got it. So the question, as you said, that I am looking at this week is motivational interviewing an effective way to help patients lose weight? To answer that question, the researchers in this study looked through six databases and two trial registries to identify randomized controlled trials that evaluated the use of motivational interviewing techniques to help participants lose weight. They found 46 studies with more than 11,000 participants. They included people over 12 years of age, so this was both adolescents and adults, comparing motivational interviewing with some kind of minimal intervention, a similar intensity non-motivational interviewing intervention, or a lower intensity behavioral program that did not include motivational interviewing, which, as you know, comprises written materials combined with counseling provided by a wide range of clinicians. Motivational interviewing is a specific kind of technique that they did define in this study. Most of the studies did have some kind of risk of bias, either due to unclear randomization or dropouts. They followed sort of standard meta-analysis techniques in this study. At 6 months, the motivational interviewing was slightly more effective than minimal intervention, producing an average weight loss of a kilogram. So the standardized mean difference that they found was minus 8.88. But it was no better than lower intensity or similar intensity interventions. So it was better than doing a little bit, but not better than other interventions that had sort of a similar amount of intervention with the patients. At 1 year and beyond, again, no difference between lower and similar intensity. High heterogeneity among the studies, as you can imagine, it's a sort of highly tailored kind of intervention motivational interviewing is. So you would expect some differences among the groups. So the bottom line here is that motivational interviewing provided by counselors to adolescents and adults with overweight and obesity does not seem to be more effective at inducing substantial or sustained weight loss. And I want to be clear, this doesn't mean that it's a bad idea or that we should quit doing it, especially because it's not like we have so many other much more effective therapies for obesity. Just that when we engage patients with motivational interviewing, we have to be realistic about expectations. And it's a form of therapy that may be effective for some patients, but it's not necessarily the number one best intervention that we have. The biggest takeaway, of course, is that it takes time to create change and more intensive interventions, thinking, you know, greater than 10 hours over 6 to 12 months, generally lead to more weight loss in obesity trials than anything that is shorter or less time intensive. Henry, what do you think?
I don't know. I think you hit on some of the important issues. One is that the risk of bias in the studies was not great, but we're willing to tolerate poor quality studies when the intervention is low risk, The benefits are potentially great. The costs are low, and when we don't have many alternatives. Now, I never learned how to do motivational interviewing, and I think it's in concept, it's pretty interesting because it may carry over to any other behavior change. So it's not just something you might use for weight loss. And it's one of those directive approaches that allows us to kind of explore what a person's potential barriers or areas of ambivalence are with regards to behavior change, to identify maybe strategies from the patient's perspective about where those might be resolved. And it kind of empowers the patient to then choose which things they might want to tackle first. So it's got a lot of attractiveness to it. What I don't know is how long does it take to learn how to do motivational interviewing, and if it's the kind of thing that you could delegate to one of your office staff. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm just picturing the control group, the unmotivated interviewing group, which would be like, it's just a couple of pounds. Don't worry about it. You know, I don't think that's what the control group was actually. But yeah, what struck me also, Kate, was what you said about the intensity. And for behavioral interventions, intensity and duration are really important, no matter what you're trying to do. For counseling regarding sexually transmitted infections in high-risk persons, for weight loss, for tobacco use, the intensity and the duration really seem to matter a lot. And low-intensity interventions, the kind of things that we might want to do in a primary care office, are going to be much less effective than things where we have to refer somebody. So I think it's really incumbent on us, and I'm sure, you know, our primary care colleagues who are listening know this, that we need to identify the resources in the community that are available for our patients that can provide that more intensive, longer duration therapy if it's there. So great study, Kate. And I think you also have a quiz for us.
I sure do. So this week's quiz is, which of the following is not a Choosing Wisely recommendation from the American Academy of Pediatrics? A, do not perform diagnostic imaging to establish the diagnosis of cryptorchidism. B, do not routinely order a screening EKG as part of a sports pre-participation examination in asymptomatic, otherwise healthy patients with no personal or family history of cardiac disease. C, avoid ordering vitamin D concentrations routinely in otherwise healthy children, including children who are overweight or obese. D, avoid referring most children with umbilical hernias to a pediatric surgeon until around age 3 years. Or E, avoid routinely measuring thyroid function and or insulin levels in children with obesity. Stay tuned.
You got to really draw that stay tuned, like Henry does. Stay tuned. Got a little theater into it.
We'll work on
your years in the theater.
My many years in the theater.
Many years in the theater. Yes. Yes. Henry, tell us about gout.
So this next study by Dalbeth and colleagues was published in Arthritis and Rheumatology this past June. It asks whether intensive urate lowering improves outcomes in persons with erosive gout. This was a double-blind randomized trial that took place in rheumatology clinics in New Zealand. Now, the study lasted about 2 years, and they identified or enrolled 100 persons who had gout and at least one bone erosion in one of the bones of their feet. Okay. And they randomized them to either intensive urate lowering therapy with a target less than 3.4 milligrams per deciliter or standard therapy, which was a modest 5 milligram per deciliter target. Now, during the first 3 months of the study, they saw the patients every month to try to see whether they were at target, and they made dose manipulations based on a specific protocol. And the protocol started with allopurinol, and they increased the doses up to 900 milligrams per day. That's a lot. And if that didn't work, then they added probenecid that they could then escalate. And if after escalation at that level, they still weren't at target, then they could add febuxostat or something called benzbromarone, which is another xanthine oxidase inhibitor that's not available in the U.S. And Now, partway through this, they had to modify their protocol because there were some concerns raised about febuxostat and cardiac complications. So anyway, after 2 years of follow-up, there were about 14% of the participants who dropped out, which is, it's not the threshold to be really panicky, but it's a relatively high dropout. Only half of the patients in the intensive therapy actually achieve their target after 1 year, compared to about 80% in the standard therapy group. If you go out 2 years, the rates went up to 62% and still 83% in the standard therapy group. Did it do anything meaningful? Well, the erosions worsened by the same degree. Patients didn't experience less pain, fewer attacks, improved quality of life, or anything else that a person would like. Not surprising, though, in the intensive therapy group needed higher doses of medication. 12 of the 50 required additional medication compared with only 2 in the standard therapy. And the rate of adverse events was about the same in both groups. So the bottom line, like what we're seeing in other kinds of settings with managing our patients with type 2 diabetes and other conditions, that more intensive therapy does not necessarily mean better outcomes. Mark.
Yeah, it's this. I think it's driven by this idea of restoring people to the physiologically optimal level. So getting that blood sugar back down to A1C is under 6.5% or whatever. And it turns out that really doesn't make that much any difference, and in some cases can be harmful. At least there was no harms here. The amount of medicine, they're about 50% more medicine. So instead of maybe 2 pills a day, they had 3. And so that's, you know, for cost, convenience, all those things, I think that's a good thing. So I like seeing studies like this that, you know, call into question physiologically based reasoning and say, hey, does it really matter in the real world? Kate?
Yeah, this one really does reinforce that we're paying attention to how people feel in this case. And there may be a threshold where, you know, with gout, where we're looking to lower the uric acid level below a certain level, but it isn't back to normal. And as you said, we've seen that with plenty of other things, not only blood sugar, but also hemoglobin levels and anemia, you know, especially in people with chronic kidney disease. We aren't looking to take them back to normal. That seems to be associated with like strokes and other things that we might want to avoid. We can add gout to that level. It's also a little bit problematic that, again, you know, some of the medications that they used in this study are not things that we currently use on a regular basis, including that febuxostat. Because of those cardiovascular harms, we're pretty much stuck with the allopurinol, which is, I guess, for the benefit. It's a good thing that they didn't find any benefit to the medications because we can't use them anymore.
Excellent. Okay. Let's see here. What do we have next? Oh, yeah, it's my turn. Screening for anal high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesions reduces progression to cancer. So we've given away the bottom line already here. This was in the New England Journal by Pilevsky et al. And it's I picked this one because it's kind of a novel screening target. Persons living with HIV are at high risk of anal cancer. We know that. This question hasn't been addressed yet by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, but you know, I suspect it might be because of this study. Some clinicians, you know, on their own have been recommending screening for anal cancer because of these high rates in persons living with HIV. And they use a liquid-based cytology, kind of like pap smears, and high-resolution anoscopy. And this study recruited persons 35 and older living with HIV to come in for anal cancer screening. The median age was about 50 years. 78% were men, 42% were Black. The groups were similar at the start of the study, and analysis was by intention to treat. So they screened over 10,000 persons initially. Of those, 4,400 had high-grade squamous intraepithelial or HSIL lesions. Those folks were randomized to get either immediate treatment. What's that?
Wow, that's half.
That's almost half. Yes, it's almost half. So very high percentage, very high prevalence. And it may have been that people who were coming in or chose to accept the invitation might have been higher risk than average, but in any case, it's high. So they were randomized to either get immediate treatment or to go into an active surveillance program to just watch the lesions, make sure they weren't progressing beyond HSIL. Treatment was selected by the clinician. They could choose ablative therapies or topical therapies like 5-FU. All of the patients got high resolution anoscopy on their return visits to look for either recurrence if they were immediately treated or progression if they're in the active surveillance group. The follow-up and the adherence were really good. Anal cancer was detected during the follow-up period of about 2 years and occurred significantly less often in the treatment group than in the active surveillance group. There were 9 in those who were treated immediately who had a recurrence versus 21 who progressed in the surveillance group. So that's about 0.9% versus 1.8%. Number needed to treat to prevent one incident anal cancer was a little over 100. There were more serious adverse events in the immediate treatment group because they had immediate treatment, things like pain, infections related to biopsy, skin ulceration, but these were actually quite rare. Bottom line, immediate treatment of screen-detected anal HSIL in high-risk persons who are living with HIV reduces the likelihood of progression to invasive anal cancer, NNT of about 111 over 26 months. This study was not powered to look at a reduction in mortality, but you know, hopefully those data are coming as well. What do you think, Kate?
Yeah, so the local LGBTQ serving FQHC that I take recommendations from at the moment already recommend annual screening for anal HPV and anal dysplasia in people. I want to say it's over 30, similar to our PAP recommendation, cervical PAP recommendations. For people over 30 who are living with HIV, and for people with men who have sex with men who have receptive anal intercourse. So that's sort of I take their recommendations because there's such a paucity of other good recommendations. So having this kind of extra evidence is awfully helpful in supporting those current recommendations. And it is just a regular we use just sort of regular PAP equipment to do the to do anal PAPs in our office. So nice to see. We do have to refer out for anoscopy. We don't do anoscopy in our office. But, good to see. It's good evidence. And that is a pretty powerful NNT for 100 plus over 26 months. It's pretty powerful. Henry?
Yeah. So this is very new to me, and I'm assuming that it's novel to many of our listeners. So I'm glad that you brought this to our attention. Clearly, this is a high-risk population. I apologize for my outburst, but about nearly 50% actually having high-grade lesions, which is just absolutely astounding to me. On the other hand, there is this sort of is the glass half full idea in that less than 2% actually progressed. And so there can be some reassurance here that if for some reason you miss or the patient declines to go through early treatment, that as long as they're being surveyed, that there is a certain level that that they can be reassured that they're actually very unlikely to progress to invasive cancer. So this might be a place where maybe some shared decision making might come in, to where person who might trade off the short term inconveniences and discomfort from treatment versus the long term ramifications.
Yeah, this was that's why I picked this one. In fact, Henry, I texted Henry this morning because I'd stupidly picked a poem that we covered a few episodes ago and wanted to talk about it again. And so Henry said, no, Mark, excuse me. And I said, how about platelet-rich plasma for knee injections? And he's like, oh, my God, no, we've done that too many times. So I tried to find something that was novel, and this certainly is. And I think one of the things for me would be, you know, you mentioned that you refer out for the anoscopy, and I wonder if that's something that in the future primary care physicians will be learning to do to make it more convenient for our patients, particularly if you're working in a setting where you have a lot of patients who are at high risk for anal cancer. And, you know, it seems like that would make sense for those clinicians to get that additional training. And hopefully that's something we'll see, especially if this becomes a standard of care. Okay, Kate, tell us the answer. And I think I know this one.
All right. So to briefly remind you, the question is, which of the following is not a choosing wisely recommendation? Should we not do imaging for cryptorchidism? Should we not do screening EKGs in sports physicals? Should we not do vitamin D levels in healthy kids? Should we not refer kids for umbilical hernias until age 3? Or should we not be doing TSHs in children with obesity? So I realize this is a hard one because it's a negative question. So the question is, what should you not avoid doing? But the correct answer here is D. We should avoid referring children with umbilical hernias until at least ages 4 to 5. So this is also tricky because the only thing that is incorrect about it is the threshold. It's the number of years the kid should be. The others are all accurate recommendations from various sections of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And I realize hopefully this is something where we know people who are currently doing these things and we can point them to the Choosing Wisely website to encourage them to think hard. The last thing I'll say about these, Choosing Wisely, of course, the point of it is to encourage conversations. So these are not necessarily practice recommendations. They are things that are meant to provoke conversations between clinicians and patients. So have a discussion with your patient or your clinician if they are encouraging you to do these things.
This brings back some great memories for me. My very first practice in Appalachia, a little isolated coal mining community, the number of young, mostly males with these umbilical hernias wearing their belly binders because grandma said that they're supposed to wear the meemaw. So the literature on this is actually pretty interesting. You just leave them alone and they heal over.
Yeah, I wish this should have come out about 60 years ago because I had my umbilical hernia repaired at the age of 1 year in Montreal, Moab. So, oh well, too late. Great one, very sneaky, tricky, Kate, okay, but very good. And lots of things we should avoid doing, which is always good to know. So thank you, Henry and Kate. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Again, if you want to get CME credit, IFP.com, click on their online IFP education webpage. They are accredited by the ACCME to provide CME credit. This is designated for a half AMA Category 1 credit. If we could just talk longer, we could give our listeners a full credit, but we're only talking about half an hour, so wah, wah. Anyway, you can read their disclosure on the IFP website. Thank you for joining us. Hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends about our podcast. Spread the word on social media. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.